Welcome back to Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture. I am your host, Isaac Weishaupt. Today, we're going to talk about the greatest horror film of all time, arguably. We're talking about Halloween from 1978, the John Carpenter classic about slashing murderer Michael Myers. We're going to go through the entire film, load it down with all the fun facts you could ever want. We're going to go through the historic cast and all the things that they've done since this film. We're going to go through the actual film. Then we're going to talk about some symbolism. There's some symbolism to consider here. That mask. Why do you think the mask is so iconic? Because it resonates on the subconscious level of the occult manifestation of, you know what it is, the subconscious. But we're going to get into that after we go through the film. Because I want to refresh you on the film. We're going to talk a little bit about the pagan holiday of Samhain, Samhain as they call it in Halloween 2. And then I'm going to float to you a theory that I came up with, that Michael Myers, I believe, is an alien and Dr. Loomis is really the bad guy. That's right. It's all happening today. Because you know, every year I like to do a little special Halloween show. All right. And I thought, why haven't we covered this film? And it's because this podcast is all about the occult symbolism within films and the esoteric practices and the Illuminati and all this stuff and where it meets pop culture. And for a while I thought, well, it's not really an Illuminate confirmed kind of film. But I think we can make some things work, all right? So let's just have a good time today, because this show is going to be a love letter to Halloween from 1978. Now, as I do with every film that we analyze here, let's do a little preamble. Should you watch this film? If you are one of the six people on Earth that have not seen Halloween from 1978, I don't know what to tell you. If you like horror, you've already seen it. If you don't like horror, this might be one of the greatest of all time. It's definitely the best slasher of all time. Now, as far as my personal favorite, I think Nightmare on Elm Street gets the edge there. Just on personal preference, but it doesn't matter. Some days I prefer one over the other. They're all great, but yes, you should watch it. How long is it? You already know. The perfect length, 91 minutes. Of the full runtime. That includes the credits. John Carpenter, why are you so good to us? Who's in it? And this is going to be a long section here. This is going to be much longer than usually, than we usually do. I am going to go through the cast. It's, of course, directed by John Carpenter, a legend that needs no introduction. If you picked up my book, Aliens, UFOs, and the Occult, Use Your Illusion 2. That's the second book where we talk about films and the occult symbolism of the phenomenon within them. We went through the John Carpenter Apocalypse Trilogy. Right? We went through, which is not Halloween. It is The Thing, Prince of Darkness, and In the Mouth of Madness. And I dedicated a whole section to John Carpenter. So we're not going to dig too deep on that right now. But the iconic soundtrack that John Carpenter provided is what makes this film so great. And you'll even hear that on the director's commentaries. I actually watched this film to prepare for this show. I watched the film twice. I watched every single Halloween movie and made a ranking on my Letterboxd. We'll talk about that at the end. I'd like to give you a nice little sales pitch to go follow me on Letterboxd at the end. And then I also watched the director's commentary version of Halloween. All right. And then I read some stuff online. But even on the director's commentary and the document, there's documentaries about it. There's a show on Netflix, The Movies We Love. It goes on and on and on, right? They were saying that they were doing a showing without the music and it was not received well, was not scary. But then Carpenter added the music and boom, classic. And they mentioned, one of the actors mentioned that when they would screen this thing in the theaters, they would notice that some of the people watching the film, instead of covering their eyes, would cover their ears. They would keep watching, but they would cover their ears because it freaked them out, you know? And when you watch the first Halloween 1978 here, they drop these nasty little stingers here and there. That's what they call it in the biz, stingers. But Carpenter, I found it interesting. Carpenter had the whole music, the whole score in his head before they even filmed. And he said he owed it to Dario Argento's Suspiria and the Tubular Bells from The Exorcist. Both classic films, of course, as well. In fact, we talked about Suspiria on this very podcast already. The 2018 Luca Guadagnino remake. I believe I did a show on that one. Anyhow. But it's not only John Carpenter on this thing. It's co-written and produced by Deborah Hill. She worked with John Carpenter many times. She worked with him on The Fog, as well as The Escape from New York, Escape from Los Angeles, Halloween 2, Halloween 3, and a whole bunch of stuff. She's got quite the resume. She also produced other classics like Clue and Adventures in Babysitter. Babysitting. I was thinking about my sister and I said it. Shout out Sister Weishaupt. We used to watch that movie as kids all the time. Yeah, Adventures in Babysitting and Clue she also produced. Sadly, she died in 2005 from cancer. So, rest in peace, Deborah Hill. Then we've got the mysterious Mustafa Akkad. This is a guy, back when the story is that John Carpenter was in England and Mustafa Akkad was like, hey, I want to make this film. And John Carpenter was actually offered $300,000 by a guy named Irwin Yablans to make the Halloween movie, but he called it The Babysitter Murders, which you'll hear referenced if you watch the 2018 Halloween film that was supposed to be sort of a sequel to the original 1978 Halloween film. If you're into Halloween, you'll know the storyline is completely butchered. It's a total mess. Every film seems to ruin it a little more. Another conversation for another day. Anyhow, Carpenter was like, I got a better idea. Let's go with a Halloween-themed movie instead of just murdering babysitters. We'll come back to that later, but even with this whole cast and crew and the people responsible for Halloween, were all very interesting. Even Mustafa Akkad, he actually also, like, was it Deborah Hill? Deborah Hill, 2005. He also died in 2005. But the way he died, him and his daughter were killed in the Amman bombings, apparently. But he was only producer to work on the first 8 Halloween films, and then I believe his son continued to work on them. You'll notice in the credits there's a different Akkad. I didn't write his name down. Anyway. But if you want to squeeze some more occult symbolism into this episode, it appears that Mustafa Akkad, was producing a film starring Sean Connery in 2005 when he was killed. All right? And this film was about Saladin and the Crusades. And this is a reference to Saladin is the secret society known as the Assassins that had these occult mysteries and allegedly taught them to the Knights Templar. So if you've been with me for a long time, you know we've talked about these subjects many, many times. We also have the famous Jamie Lee Curtis. She plays Laurie Strode. And that name, Laurie Strode, allegedly the name of one of John Carpenter's girlfriends. But this was her actual film debut. And I recall during the director's commentary, she mentioned that she was getting ready to give up acting. And then this one hit it big and boom. Major A-plus actor, right? And John Carpenter actually didn't. He originally wanted the daughter of June Lockhart from Lassie. If you're not an old turd like me, Lassie was this old black and white TV show about what kind of dog was that? I don't remember. It doesn't matter. It's an old dog show. And that's what John Carpenter wanted, the daughter from the June Lockhart from Lassie on it. But then they opted for Jamie Lee Curtis. Her mother was in Psycho. Her mother was Janet Leigh, which I don't believe was the character that got the infamous shower slashing scene. We also have the great Donald Pleasance, who plays Dr. Loomis. Arguably the character that makes the whole Halloween franchise, I would argue. We talked about Donald Pleasance again in Aliens, UFOs, and the Occult, Usual Illusion 2, because he's in many Carpenter movies, including the Apocalypse trilogy. We talked about him. We talked about his amazing life story. He's featured in a ton of relevant films when you get into the occult film studies here. THX 1138 by George Lucas. He was in the 1984 TV version. He was in You Only Live Twice, the James Bond film where he plays Dr. Evil, basically. That was an inspiration for Dr. Evil. And according to the documentary I watched called Unmasked about Halloween, this 1978 movie, and he didn't die until like 2000-something, this was his 108th appearance. He was on a ton of stuff. This guy was so busy. I think he was even writing a kid's book. I mean, this guy didn't stop. Now, Carpenter originally offered the role of Dr. Loomis to Christopher Lee, and he passed on it, and later Christopher Lee regretted it. And supposedly, I heard in one of the documentaries that Carpenter also offered it to Peter Cushing. You know, both of those guys are very famous with the Hammer horror stuff, right? And Christopher Lee infamously studied the occult, you know? We also have PJ Souls playing the role of Linda. She was in Carrie, Rock and Roll High School, Stripes, and The Devil's Rejects. Yes, Rob Zombie. We love Rob Zombie here on the podcast. She was also in the 2018 Halloween, which, again, that was the sequel, the remake of the sequel. And, of course, Rob Zombie did the two Halloween movies. Not well received. Most people hate the Rob Zombie Halloweens. I think they were great, but don't listen to me. Huge Rob Zombie stan right here. So, yeah, but she was in The Devil's Rejects. Also, Nancy Loomis plays Annie. Her real name is Nancy Kies. I guess her acting name was Nancy Loomis, which is very confusing. You may think the Dr. Loomis name has something to do with Nancy Loomis being in it, but it's not. Dr. Loomis's name comes from the name Sam Loomis, who was Janet Leigh's boyfriend in Psycho. And of course, we already said Janet Leigh is Jamie Lee Curtis's mother. Anyway, Nancy Loomis, she was in The Fog. She was in Halloween 2. She was in Halloween 3. In Halloween 3, she played Linda Chalice. There's a character played by Tom Atkins. If you haven't seen Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, it's a great one. It's the only one in the franchise without Michael Myers, but it's arguably maybe even the best one, you could say. But it centers around the main character played by Tom Atkins. He's this doctor. He's a womanizing doctor. And his ex-wife is Linda Chalice, played by Nancy Loomis. And you'll find in these Halloween movies, they insist on showing us how the medical industry is full of scumbags. And Tom Atkins' character, Dr. Chalice, is a total scumbag, right? Anyway, Nancy Loomis, at one time, she was married to Tommy Lee Wallace, the director of Halloween 3, and the guy who directed Halloween 3 also directed It, this series on TV from the 90s. And he was one of many to don the shape mask from Halloween, which was, you know, created from, what's the dude, Star Trek? Oh, man, why am I not remembering it? The guy from Star Trek. Almost did a show with him, too. What's that guy's name? Man, my brain is mushy today. I am the most famous guy. The most famous guy. Oh, boy. This is really embarrassing, everybody. Captain Kirk, right? What's Captain Kirk's name? You guys are... William Shatner. Holy crap. You should just turn me off. Fire me now. William Shatner. Almost got to do an episode of The Unexplained with William Shatner. I was this close. But then, you know, things happen. That's how the entertainment biz goes, you know? It giveth and taketh. Gets you excited, then pulls the rug out. Anyway, Nick Castle, he plays Michael Myers, a.k.a. The Shape. They call him The Shape often when you get into this Halloween dissection, right? Tony Moran, Tommy Lee Wallace, they each had the mask on as well, but Nick Castle is mostly credited for being Michael Myers in the first one. Kyle Richards stars as Lindsay Wallace. Now, Kyle, nowadays you think of a guy punching drywall wearing a monster cap. That's not it. It's a chick, and she's in her 50s. She looks great. But she was in Little House on the Prairie, but she came back into the Halloween franchise to do Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends, the, you know, 2022 final installation of Halloween. Yeah, right. Now, something interesting I did not know about Kyle Richards, she was also a reality TV star. She was in Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. She was also in The New Celebrity Apprentice. And oh, by the way, her Wikipedia also claims that she is a Kabbalist, a follower of the esoteric Hebrew mysticism known as Kabbalah. We talk about it on the show all the time. Oh, and guess who her nieces are? Paris and Nikki Hilton. Or should I say Nikki Hilton Rothschild? Yes, she married into the Rothschild family. Again, one of the supposed Illuminati bloodlines. It means red shield in German. I mean, why do we pick on the Rothschilds? Because they established the banking industry in Europe. And of course, the banking industry was, the idea of such a thing was given to us by the Knights Templar, who were taught the occult secrets by the assassins and Saladin, which we already talked about how Mustafa Akkad was making a film about that subject when he died. Just saying. But this Meyer Amschel Rothschild in the 1760s started these banks. They're one of the wealthiest families in the world. They've got their fingers in a lot of pies, okay? And the theories are that Meyer Rothschild secretly ran the Illuminati. No evidence, though, but that's another topic for another day. Brian Andrews plays Tommy Doyle. Now, the character Tommy Doyle, that's the kid that Laurie Strode is babysitting. Tommy Doyle is actually an homage to a Hitchcock film called Rear Window, which ironically, I've watched the first half of. It was very interesting, and then they removed it from whatever streaming service I was watching. So I got to finish it someday. Now, fun fact, Brian Andrews was in 3 o'clock High, which was shot in Ogden, Utah, my backyard, which is also where they filmed Halloween 4, 5, and 6, as well as The Sandlot. Shout out to Victor, played Timmy Timmons. He's listening right now, guarantee it. Now, Tommy Doyle in Halloween 6, The Curse of Michael Myers, is played by Paul Rudd. Don't ask. If you haven't made it that far down the Halloween rabbit hole, you're going to be disappointed. Because once you get past 3, it gets really rough. You're in for a rough ride. Peter Griffith plays Morgan Strode. That's Laurie's father, the realtor. Very minor role, right? Why are we talking about him? Because, again, like everyone else involved, very interesting. He would have some kids. One of those kids was Melanie Griffith. Melanie Griffith would also have some kids. And that included Dakota Johnson, who was in the 2018 Suspiria remake. Which was very odd. Because John Carpenter was so inspired by Suspiria, that's what inspired his music. Strange, right? Strange connections. My goodness. Okay, what's this movie about? Because we're gonna go through the film right now. So if you haven't seen it, I don't know why you haven't. I would advise you to do so. If not, that's fine. Come along for the journey. It's Here's the plot from Wikipedia. The plot centers on a mental patient, Michael Myers, who was committed to a sanitarium for murdering his babysitting teenage sister on Halloween night when he was 6 years old. 15 years later, he escapes and returns to his hometown, where he stalks a female babysitter and her friends while under pursuit by his psychiatrist. It's so good. All right. So, without further ado, let's get into the film Halloween from 1978.
Halloween night. A small American town. 15 years ago. Michael? Halloween.
All right, right off the bat, we've got the credits itself are great. It's got the pumpkin with a slice that goes, it's a jack-o'-lantern carved out of a pumpkin. It's got a slice running from its nose to its mouth. A C for effort. Good try, everybody. The eyes and the mouth are crooked. I mean, it's wild, right? Low budget. This was low budget stuff. And I'm going to put the photos on my Instagram for all the things I will be discussing today. Instagram.com/IsaacWeishaupt. Link in the show notes, as always. Now, I've heard that the reason the opening credits shows the jack-o'-lantern with the connected mouth-to-nose slice was done on purpose. You could argue it's the Curse of Thorn, which comes up in Halloween 6. I don't believe that, though, because this is way before that. But yeah, I heard it was put there on purpose. I don't know if that's true. I think they were just being very efficient with their time. Now, the first scene, we're in 1963. It's Halloween night. We see a house. It's got the jack-o'-lantern on the porch. That's not a crooked jack-o'-lantern. And we've got a young man trying to get it in. He's got a clown mask that he wears for a split second, takes it off. And we're watching this through the point of view of a person, right? Someone's watching through the windows, right? And this is a giallo technique from the, you know, talking about Dario Argento. He was one of the godfathers of giallo, where they would go around and murder people, and you would witness the murders through the point of view of the murderer sometimes. Well, we see that this person, they watch through the windows, they go into the house, and just that fast, the young man, he got it in and he's done already. I mean, it was 15 seconds tops. So he leaves the house. The POV camera, it's going upstairs and it sees this nude girl. She screams, "Michael!" because he's got a big old knife, and he proceeds to stab her and he kills her. Now, of course, this is the young Michael Myers. Fun fact, this is the only nudity in the first film. Plus, the actress who gets murdered is Sandy Johnson. She was Playmate of the Month in June 1974, 4 years before this film. She would go on to get a PhD, so good for her. So, young Michael, he stabs up this woman. He leaves the house. That's his sister, by the way. And the parents see him. They see him standing there with a clown outfit. He's got the bloody butcher knife. And he was apparently wearing the clown mask that the, you know, boyfriend was messing around with. Now, this camera technique John Carpenter used was called Panoglide. It was inspired from Hitchcock. Because the movie had to be simple in order to work. And when they talk about this on the director's commentary, this iconic opening scene, there was actually a whole crew inside the house, like turning lights on, turning them off as the point of view camera was moving around, because the lighting changes the focus of the camera and the lens. And they said this was actually the last day of filming because they had used this busted up old house, the Myers house, throughout the whole film. But then at the end, they cleaned it up so they could film this last shot. And that freeze shot of the parents finding Michael, a six-year-old boy, standing there with a bloody butcher knife is amazing, right? So now we go over to Halloween, October 30th, 1978. All right, we're talking 15 years later. Smith's Grove. And again, another terrifying, iconic scene. We've got a nurse and the unhinged Dr. Loomis driving in a car, and it's raining. And we're introduced to Dr. Loomis. He kind of keeps it together a little bit. And they're headed to the hospital to pick up Michael Myers because he's been locked up in an insane asylum for 15 years and hasn't spoken a word. And Dr. Loomis, who is Michael Myers' psychiatrist, has zero compassion. He calls Michael it. It's Pierre Evil. Oh, man, Dr. Loomis makes the show. So Loomis, he's riding shotgun, and he picks up a pack of matches, and it gives him pause, and it says Rabbit in Red. And the camera focuses in on this like it's some kind of important part of the storyline, some kind of intriguing thing, and they never really address it. We don't really know what it is. If you watch the Rob Zombie Halloween remakes, he asserts that it's a strip club. If so, that must mean, ipso facto, the nurse driving the car is a stripper. Which would explain why when Loomis looks at the matchbook, he gives a sort of judgmental look, right? Anyway, we're watching through the windshield. It's dark, it's rainy, and boom, there's these figures standing all over the road like cattle. And the nurse slams the brakes. Loomis gets out to inspect. One of these nuts, they crawl up the back of a car. They attack the nurse. She gets out. The patient gets in and takes off in her station wagon. And, Loomis, he's panicking, right? He's like, oh, my God, he's gone. The evil is gone. He's screaming, like a psychiatrist would. Totally unhinged. And that's obviously Michael Myers. Now, in the director's commentary, we find out that the guy climbing on the car as Michael Myers was, of course, Nick Castle. He said it was freezing that night. They were hosing him with cold-ass water. He said it was a total nightmare. But he was actually trying to capture a form of mental illness when he was doing his movements as what they call the shape. Now, we move on to another scene in Haddonfield, Illinois, which is a fictional place. The name comes from Haddonfield, New Jersey, a real place, which is where Debbie Hill's high school was growing up. You might think, well, did they film it in Haddonfield, New Jersey? No, they filmed it in Pasadena, California, which is, they had to dodge palm trees. You can see how everything is green. They filmed it in May. They filmed it in spring. But that's how good they did. You have no idea. Anyways, daytime. And Lori she's walking. She's taking a key over to the Myers house because she's going to leave a key for someone who apparently wants to buy the house. We find out that her dad is a realtor. We confirm that in Halloween 2 more. And we see the shape. Michael Myers, he's staring at Lori. Was this the catalyst? Lori going to the Myers house to leave the key. Is that what's pissing Mike off so much? Next, Lori is in school, and they're talking about a book about a guy named Collins meeting his own fate, and they talk about Cosstain and Samuel's view of fate. The teacher couldn't be any snarkier, by the way. And she says stuff like, fate never changes, it's the last thing we see. And this is a sort of common trope you'll see in a lot of these horror movies where they'll have a classroom scene. We saw it in Nightmare on Elm Street. But there are many like it, but this one is ours. Take a listen.
And the book ends. But what Samuels is really talking about here is fate. You see, fate caught up with several lives here. No matter what course of action Collins took, he was destined to his own fate. His own day of reckoning for himself. The idea is that destiny is a very real, concrete.
Ma'am?
Answer the question.
Oh, Costain wrote that fate was somehow related only to religion, whereas Samuels felt that, well, fate was like a natural element, like earth, air, fire, and water.
That's right. Samuels definitely personified fate. In Samuels' writing, fate is immovable, like a mountain. It stands where man passes away. Fate never changes.
So we hear this talk about fate and how fate is immovable. It never changes. And they actually revisit this idea in the, I believe it's the 2018 Halloween. There's another classroom scene where Laurie Strode's granddaughter is in class and they're talking about fate as well. And guess who's outside her window staring at her? Your boy, Michael Myers. So then we're introduced to Tommy Doyle. He's getting bullied. And Michael Myers, he's hanging out by the schoolyard. And he's like, you know what? I hate this kid too. I'm going to get some bullying in too. And he starts stalking Tommy. Probably because he saw Tommy hanging out with Laurie Strode earlier. Because Laurie's his babysitter. Then let's catch up with crazy Dr. Loomis. Dr. Loomis, he's on the phone at a payphone warning Haddonfield about Myers being headed their way. And it kind of doesn't make any sense because not the nitpick, right? It kind of doesn't make sense because outside the mental hospital, Michael Myers steals the station wagon. Dr. Loomis is there at the same time. Michael Myers takes off in the station wagon that night. It's now morning time. And I guess maybe the idea is Dr. Loomis just walked to a payphone. I don't know. But anyways, what I want you to listen to is Carpenter does this weird thing with these annoying sounds. Again, to support the idea that the soundtrack is what makes the movie. He does these things with these uneasy sounds. Like you'll listen, Dr. Loomis is on the phone and there's this train. Like, it's like, you want to hear the world's most annoying sound? Here comes this train. Take a listen.
You've got to believe me, officer. He is coming to Haddonfield. Because I know him. I'm his doctor. You must be ready for him. If you don't, it's your funeral.
Now, this scene doesn't make any sense. Loomis again sees the matchbook about the red rabbit that the nurse had. There's a dead man next to the matchbook, next to a broken down truck. Loomis apparently doesn't even see the dead body. Why would Michael Myers kill him and leave the matches? I mean, that's kind of the implication that Myers on his way to Haddonfield was like, oh, I'm going to get out and bust this dude up. And he dropped the matches, I guess. I don't know. No answers given. We don't know. Back in Haddonfield, Laurie, she's walking with her two friends, Annie and Linda. Again, they see Michael Myers, the shape, stalking them in the station wagon. He's driving down the road all creepy. Annie yells, hey, jerk, speed kills. And Michael Myers, he locks up the brakes. Terrifying, right? And then he takes off. And Laurie's like, hey, Annie, you're going to get us all in deep trouble. Foreshadowing of the fate that will, chase them down. Fun fact, the station wagon Michael Myers is driving was rented for the film. But then when they were done with the film, they sold it. And it sat in a barn for decades. It was later refurbished and they show it at horror conventions. I'm going to assume in New Jersey. It's the only place that loves horror enough to have a whole convention about it. That thing still exists, right? So, Laurie, Annie, and Linda, they're walking around this neighborhood. The lawns are absolutely amazing. I mean, every dad is decked out in the hottest New Balances, keeping their grass on point. And we get the infamous Michael Myers hiding behind the hedges scene. He's peeking behind a bush all creepy style. And of course they get up to the bush and he's gone. Well, Lori Myers, she finally makes it home, and we get another iconic shot of her looking out the window, and they had laundry clotheslines, and Michael Myers was like standing amongst the clothes, and then he disappears again, right? Well, she gets a phone call from Annie. And also, by the way, in the scene, you'll see a Raggedy Ann doll. I don't know if that's connected. Maybe to Annie's, right? Also, when they're, another fun fact, when they're walking down the street, you'll see the sign Genesee Avenue. And that is, if you look at where they filmed in West Hollywood, where they filmed Halloween, it's on the corner of De Longpre and Genesee Ave. Well, 1428 North Genesee Ave is also where they filmed Nightmare on Elm Street. Small world. Anyway, back to the movie. And one of my favorite scenes to showcase how insane and savage Dr. Loomis is. Dr. Loomis goes to a cemetery, and a caretaker is going to escort him to the location of Judith Myers' tombstone. Now, Judith Myers was the Playboy model killed at the beginning of the show in 1963 by Michael. Okay? Michael killed his sister. They go to the headstone, and it's gone, right? It's missing. But what's so great is that the caretaker, he's just trying to make a human connection. He's telling a story to Dr. Loomis, and Loomis is so irritated. He's like, cool story, bro. Like, he might as well call him a mouth-breathing hick or something like that. Take a listen.
Yeah. Judith Myers. Myers. Row 18, plot 20. Yeah, you know, every town is something like this happen. I remember over in Russellville, old Charlie Bowles, about 15 years ago. One night he finished dinner and he excused himself from the table and he went out to the garage. He got himself a hacksaw. And then he went back into the house and he kissed his wife and his two children goodbye. And then he proceeded...
Where are we?
Oh, it's right over here. Yeah, Myers, Judith Myers, I remember her. Couldn't believe it. Such a young boy.
Mother, you lost?
Why do they do it? Goddamn kids. They'd do anything for Halloween.
Whose grave is it?
Oh, I know. 18, 19. Judith Myers.
He came home.
So Lori and Annie, they're smoking the grass. They're listening to a little Blue Oyster Cult, Don't Fear the Reaper. They're being tailed by your boy, though. They come up on Annie's dad. He's a semi-creepy cop. And we find out someone had broken into the hardware store and stole a mask and some knives. And you know it's the William Shatner mask, right? And this is where the mask originally comes into play. Also, here comes Loomis. Finally made it. Finally made it. It's been like 2 days of Myers stalking and bullying everybody, and here comes Loomis finally. Blue Oyster Cult's Don't Fear the Reaper, one of John Carpenter's favorite songs. You will also hear it in Rob Zombie's Halloween film. You will also hear it in The Stand, the TV series from the 90s. Also filmed in Utah at Dugway, which is where Area 52 allegedly is. Just fun facts to have fun. So Annie, she goes to the house. She's going to babysit, right? And there's Michael Myers. He's creeping behind the trees, you know, like that meme of that dude behind the trees rubbing his hands. Well, Loomis and the cop, they're now teamed up. They're investigating. And we hear about how the Myers house has been abandoned since the killing in 1963. Also, we hear Michael Myers ate a dog. So there's that. And that, you know, that's why Loomis is so crazy. That's not a man. That's pure evil. He's doing a hater's ball. You know, he's kicking him while he's down. So they're investigating this busted up old house, and a piece of like gutter smashes into the window for no reason. And Loomis, he's shook, right? He's like, whoa. He's so shook, he pulls a strap, you know, because he's a psychiatrist. Of course, he's got a gun on him. And the cop is like, bro, you're scared, bro. And Loomis goes on, he describes his past with Michael Myers, again, calling him purely. He's calling him pure evil. Imagine having a psychiatrist that drags you this hard. Like, you know, on some level, like, look, I've got a counselor I've seen for 10 years. I know on some level when he goes home, he's got to tell his wife some of this stuff, right? He probably keeps it anonymous. I'm sure he's a professional dude. But, I mean, come on. These are juicy stories, right? Like, maybe. So, anyway, Dr. Loomis, he's going in on Michael. Take a listen.
He could have seen us through this window. Standing on the lawn, he could have seen inside. You must think me a very sinister doctor. I do have a permit.
Seems to me you're just plain scared.
Yes. Yeah, I am. I met him 15 years ago. I was told there was nothing left. No reason, no conscience, no understanding, and even the most rudimentary sense of life or death, of good or evil, right or wrong. I met this 6-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes. I spent 8 years trying to reach him, and then another 7 trying to keep him locked up, because I realized that what was living behind that boy's eyes was purely and simply evil.
What do we do?
He's been here once tonight. I think he'll come back. I'm going to wait for him.
I still think I should notify the radio and television.
No. If you do that, they'll see him on every street corner. They'll look for him in every house. Just tell your men to keep their mouths shut and their eyes open.
I'll check back in an hour.
Now, fun fact, John Carpenter actually went to a mental asylum while he was in college on a field trip, and he used that experience to build up these characters, Dr. Loomis and Michael Myers and all that. So Lori, she's babysitting Tommy. She's reading King Arthur, and Tommy's like, no, I want the science fiction comics, right? Because, you know, science fiction is actually going to play a critical role when we get into this idea that Michael Myers might be an alien, all right? Meanwhile, Annie, she's babysitting at another house, and she's preparing some food. She gets it on her shirt. She's like, oh, no. So she completely strips down to her panties. And of course, you know, Michael Myers, he's watching through those windows. And then he kills the family dog for good measure. That's 2 dead dogs thus far. And we now notice that on the television sets, because back then, you have to understand, back in the 70s and 80s, that everyone would watch whatever was on the TV at the time that it was on, right? There's no DVR. There's no internet. You either caught the thing when it was on or you didn't, which was a magical time. And on the TVs, everyone is watching Howard Hawks, The Thing from Outer Space. And, you know, Lori and Tommy are obviously watching. And you see this in multiple scenes. You see the UFO specifically. Carpenter loved The Thing. That's why he redid it in the 80s. But we're going to come back to that. So Annie's kids that she's babysitting, they're also watching The Thing. And you'll see the scene where they're standing in a circle trying to like figure out the shape of this thing, right? Now, this is all very curious, because if you read my alien books, Aliens, UFOs, and the Occult, Use Your Illusion 2, we talked about how this circle shape is also depicted in John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, as well as John Carpenter's The Thing, but now we also see it in Halloween, which kind of makes sense, because they call Michael Myers the Shape. And in The Thing, they say, we are trying to figure out the shape of this thing. Just a little more fodder for this idea that maybe Michael Myers is an alien. So Annie, she takes her kid over to Lori. She's like, look, I want you to watch this kid too because I'm about to get it in. And you know there's a price to pay for that kind of naughtiness. And of course the price gets paid. Annie goes to her car after dropping her kid off to Lori. It's locked. So she goes to get the keys and comes back. And if you watch, it's a very subtle thing, but you'll notice the windows are now fogged up in her car. And she gets in, and you already know what's going to happen. There's Michael Myers in the back seat, and he gets her. The first kill second kill of the movie, technically, but anyway, I think he chokes her. So crazy Dr. Loomis, he's stalking around Haddonfield looking for Myers with the cop. And he sees some kids sneaking around the Myers house, and he scares the absolute shit out of them. And even the cop is like, bro, what are you doing, man? And he doesn't know Dr. Loomis is crazy yet, okay? So Linda, she shows up at the now empty house that Annie was babysitting. And she starts to make out with Bob, like her boyfriend. Is there a visitor lurking in the shadows? Absolutely, you know there is. So Linda and Bob, they're making sexy time in the master bedroom at the Wallace residence. They are drinking beers. They're leaving beer cans all over the floor. It's the most disrespectful thing I've ever seen in their bedroom. They couldn't even have the decency to do it in a different room. There's even a jack-o'-lantern on the nightstand lit, which makes no sense. Like, what is going on in this house? Bob lasts exactly 5 pumps. Linda thinks it's fantastic, so she starts smoking. All of this in the poor Wallace bedroom on their bed, smoking and everything. My God. Well, Bob, he makes himself right at home. And he's like, I'm going to go grab a beer from the Wallace fridge. He comes down there. Here comes Michael out of the pantry. We're like, please, Michael, make this debauchery stop. It's so bad. And he's like, I got you, fam. So he holds Bob up by the throat and shoves a butcher knife into his torso, hanging him up like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And Michael does this iconic thing where he tilts his head and stares in the eyes of Bob as he dies, right? Very inquisitively. Now, the reason this happened, John Carpenter told Nick Castle, the guy playing the Shape, to tilt his head and look at the corpse of Bob as if it were a butterfly collection.
Nailed it, right?
Now, Bob, here's another fun fact. Bob was actually supposed to be played by Dennis Quaid, who was married to PJ Souls, the actress who plays Linda in the movie. Now, in a very unexpected and out-of-place twist, Myers puts on a sheet, cuts holes in the eyes, and puts Bob's glasses on, and goes into Linda's room. She thinks it's Bob playing a joke, obvs, and proceeds to trash talk him before picking up the phone to call Laurie Strode. But here comes Myers, who Linda thinks is Bob. He comes in the room and he chokes her while she's on the phone with Laurie. She's gyrating and moaning and groaning, and Annie thinks, who's she calling? Annie. She thinks that like they're making sexy time and she just called for fun, I guess. And finally, at this point, we see the iconic Myers mask get put back on, right? Because you're like, why would Michael Myers go through, he kills Bob, then he goes through this hassle of putting the sheet on? It just doesn't make sense. It's like there's a trace of tomfoolery involved all of a sudden. It's very strange. I mean, it's iconic and it's terrifying. So things are heating up. Dr. Loomis finally spots the station wagon. It took him long enough. It took him like, well, it feels like forever. Lori is snooping around. She's looking for Annie and Paul and Bob and Linda, right? But they're all dead except for Paul. Inside the Wallace house, the lights are all off. And in this, we get another weird scene. Annie is actually lying dead in that same Wallace bed. That whole mattress is going to need replaced. This thing is a wreck. And we see Judith Meyer's headstone at the top of the bed. And Lori's like, whoa, like it finally hit her. Something's going on, something really bad. And she screams, and then she sees Bob's body swinging, and Lori is all cooped up like it's a haunted house walkthrough. It's a real mess. Michael busts through the room. He slashes at Lori but misses. They play a bunch of cat and mouse. It's horrifying. All you see is the creepy mask with the coveralls just calmly yet urgently chasing her. Lori runs out. She runs to a different house, screaming for help, pounding on the door. They look out the window at her, and then they turn off the porch light. Wow, man, they're cold-blooded. So Lori, she goes back to Tommy's house, finally. She forgot her keys. What is it with the keys in this film? Everyone's forgetting their keys. At the beginning, Lori had the keys she was dropping off at the house, and then Annie forgot her keys with the car, and that got her killed, and now Lori forgot the key, and she's about to get killed. But then Tommy's in there, thank goodness. Tommy takes his absolute sweet time to open the door, manages to get it unlocked just in time for Lori to get in there. But guess who else found a way in? Michael Myers. Come on. Lori actually stabs him in the neck with a yarn needle. But you know that's not it, Chief. You know you need more than that for Michael Myers. But she thinks she's done. She stabbed him in the neck. She takes a little break on the couch to regain her composure, as one does. And she has the knife, but she throws it down. She's going to catch a little nap real quick or whatever. She's exhausted. She ran across the street and everything, right? And it's funny because in the director's commentary, Jamie Lee Curtis said that the shot actually didn't really capture what was going on. She was actually disgusted to be holding Myers' knife. That's why she threw it down. Take that for what it's worth. Meanwhile, Dr. Loomis, he's barking orders. He's telling the cop what to do. He orders the cop to look around for Myers while he's walking around in his trench coat. Like, he's the real psycho. He's got the piece in his hand. Lori, she finally wakes up from her little slumber. And she's like, okay, I'm going to go upstairs and grab the kids. But guess who else is up now? Michael Myers. And he shows up. He's about to ruin this little party. Lori, she's hiding in the accordion door closet. Michael tracks her down. He has the hardest time with this flimsy little closet door to open, but he finally makes it work. But guess what? Lori stabs him in the eye with a wire hanger. He drops the knife. She grabs it. She stabs him in the gut with it this time. Finally, he's dead, right? Sprawled out on the carpet. It's like he's going to do snow angels. And she's like, oh, good. She throws the knife down again. Right next to Myers' body, too. But, you know, Myers is surely dead. So, okay, let me go grab the kids. I'm going to very, very slowly explain to them how they need to get out of the house. As slow as humanly possible. And she does that, and then she grabs herself just a peaceful little cat nap real quick before you see Michael do a nice full-on CrossFit ab mat sit-up in the background. And he snatches her up, and they fight. She gets his mask off. You can't get a great look at it, but that's kind of the best look you get at Michael Myers. She pulls his mask off for a second, but luckily for her, Dr. Loomis, he's crazy. Michael Myers is evil, but Loomis is crazy. Loomis suspects something's up at that Wallace house. He strolls in. He pulls a strap. He puts like 6 rounds in Myers. And then Myers goes off the bedroom roof into the front yard. Now, fun fact, this was not Nick Castle. This was actually Tony Moran. The guy who gets unmasked is Tony Moran for 1 second. So we think Myers is surely dead now. He's been shot. He's got thrown off the roof. And Lori's like, was that the boogeyman? And Loomis is like, oh, you betcha that it is. Take a listen.
What's the boogeyman?
As a matter of fact, it was.
Dr. Loomis, he gets downstairs because he's for sure going to finish the job now, unlike Laurie taking little naps all night. But bam, Myers is gone. And then Carpenter shows us shots of the house, the rooms, the neighborhood, while you hear Michael Myers breathing. Where is he? We don't know. The end. Now, fun fact, in that sequence, you can see the butcher knife in the living room, but recall, it was not there. And another fun fact, Lori and Paul survived. You know, people think Lori was the final girl, but Paul's also still alive too, right? Maybe Paul is kept alive. He was the apostle Paul to spread the story of the gospel of Michael Myers. So in conclusion, what makes this film a classic? Why are we obsessing over it every year? Because at one point it was the largest grossing film in history. $300,000 flipped into $70 million. Sadly, Carpenter and Hill didn't see much of that money. Apparently, their contract was dumb. Then they were sort of more or less forced into doing a sequel, even though they didn't want to. It was going to be done with or without them, which is kind of what happened to The Matrix 4, too, right? Matrix 4 sucked. But apparently, that's the story that they used was like, oh, it's going to be, you know, it's going to happen with or without you, so it's up to you. But Carpenter and Hill were like, fine, let's get this bread. So they did it. But the first one, this was shot in 20 days. And Carpenter says on the director's commentary that, and this was filmed in the 90s, he says it's kind of sad that they kept making these Halloween movies. At the time, he says he knows that they made a part 4 and a 5, and he hears they're making a part 6, and he's kind of like, oh, brother. But yeah, so it's a great film. It's very successful, obviously, right? But let's talk about the occult symbolism. Let's talk about the masks, right? The mask is the tool for the suppression of the ego. And you can see this with the Freemasonic rituals of initiation with the hoodwink, right? They put the mask on. It's to suppress the senses and suppress the ego. It's like achieving any altered state, all right? You need to get past the ego and the egoic structures of what the mind thinks the world surrounding it is. Like, the ego has a way of saying, you know, hey, you are Isaac Weisskopf and you record podcasts for a living or whatever, you know. And the truth is like, no, you are this something else. You are this infinite consciousness or whatever, right? Depending on who you want to listen to, David Icke, whatever. But as far as Michael Myers go, you see him getting the mask taken off when Tony Moran is taken over, right? And he's in shock when it happens if you watch that scene. It's like he has to have that mask on to commit the murders. And when it's off and he finds himself holding a butcher knife trying to kill people, he's like, whoa, that's too much. But if he puts the mask on, he can do it. Kind of like when he was 6, he was wearing the clown mask. It's the suppression of the ego so he can be a murderous psychopath. Now, fun fact, that mask, which is, of course, like we talked about, is molded by from William Shatner. It was actually for a film from 1975 called The Devil's Reign, which I watched for you, which actually had John Travolta's film debut, which I actually didn't even see him in there. But anyway, which ties us into Carrie, right? Because John Travolta was in Carrie with PJ Stiles. But The Devil's Reign is about a bunch of Satanists trying to do a little blood sacrifice action. And if you follow through the Halloween storyline, Halloween 6, The Curse of Thorin, they claim that Michael Myers is from a bloodline of druids and they do a blood sacrifice and that's why he's trying to kill the family. So is it satanic? In a way, if you follow through the storyline, even the roots of The Mask come from a satanic film. Now, in The Devil's Reign, guess who stars in it? Anton LaVey, who makes a nice little cameo at the end of the final ritual. He was a technical advisor for that film as well, which would support John Carpenter's assertion via Dr. Loomis that Michael Myers is, in fact, he's pure evil. So Anton LaVey, being in The Devil's Reign, which is where The Mask came from for Michael Myers, kind of connects it in a way, right? Maybe there's some subconscious belief and ideas that support this idea that maybe it is evil. Fun fact, Anton LaVey and his old lady were both in The Devil's Reign, and they together had a child named Xena LaVey, a.k.a. Taylor Swift. Look it up if you don't believe me. Look it up. Xena LaVey, Taylor Swift. Is it the same person? We don't know. Also, there's this theme of fate running throughout the films. John Carpenter suggested fate was a primal fear. Fate would mean a deterministic view of the world, meaning you have no control over what's going to happen. Everything's been predetermined for you, which I don't believe in. How would I know, though, right? But Laurie Strode, she was the virgin that survived. Her fate was to survive this. And in the director's commentary, they claim there was no morality attached to this thing at all. It was supposed to be more about how Laurie Strode was the naive person, nothing to do with sexuality. I don't believe that for a second. Why they wouldn't just come out with it, I don't know. Because everyone else is having sex and they're getting murdered. But her naivety keeps her safe. She's always looking for safety, keeping a level head. She's always worried about the kids, telling them extremely slowly how to get out of the house. She's like, listen, there's a mass murderer in the house. What I need you to do is to walk down those stairs, go to the front door, you turn the doorknob, then you open the door. Then you go out the door. Then you run down the street. It's so preposterous, isn't it? Doesn't matter. It's a classic movie. Now, with the occult, there's a article on The Guardian saying that the film Halloween was actually a reference to the occult holiday of Samhain. I'm going to read you from The Guardian. By Hill's recollection, that's Deborah Hill, by Hill's recollection, the script took 3 weeks to write, and much of the inspiration behind the plot came from Celtic traditions of Halloween, such as the festival of Samhain. Although Samhain is not mentioned in the plot of the first film, Hill asserts that, and then has a quote. So it wasn't mentioned in Halloween 1, but Halloween 2 it does, all right? Okay, but here's what Deborah Hill says. The idea was that you couldn't kill evil, and that was how we came about the story. We went back to the old idea of Samhain, that Halloween was the night where all the souls are let out to wreak havoc on the living, and then came up with the story about the most evil kid who ever lived. And when John came up with this fable of a town with a dark secret of someone who once lived there, and now that evil has come back, that's what made Halloween work. So there you go. Based on an occult idea. I think on some levels, we all find this movie terrifying and scary because of the dark occult Samhain roots, as well as, I'm going to go ahead and say it, the satanic Anton LaVey connection with The Mask. Now, to wrap up this fun fest, let's talk about this theory I've got here, all right? We have to know about Michael Myers. Who's Michael Myers? There's very minimal violence in this film. This isn't one of those gore fests like Saw or Hostel. And it's terrifying because most of the horror and the terror and the murder and the violence takes place inside the viewer's mind, all right? The viewer is the one anticipating and waiting for the violence to happen. Most of it happens in the shadows. And the whole thing with Michael Myers refusing to die was based on Carpenter's fondness of Westworld, not the show, the movie, with Yul Brynner from back in the day. Just like Yul Brynner, the robot, Myers was evil, and evil, of course, won't die. Now, Michael Myers, this is a fun fact, Michael Myers was the name of a British company called Miracle Films that distributed Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13, and the guy running it was named Michael Myers, and supposedly they chose his name as a tribute. Seems weird, but hey, that's what it says. Now, here's the theory I want to float. What if Dr. Loomis is the real villain here? Dr. Loomis seems like a bad guy, first off. Let's talk about that. In all the films, he's totally unhinged, totally crazy. In this film, he's scaring the little kids trick-or-treating unnecessarily when they get too close to the Myers home. It's like he's trying to protect them, but he also like really gets off on it. He has this creepy grin when he does it. He's mean as hell to his patients. He calls Michael Myers pure evil and proceeds to try and kill him. He's walking around with the strap. And in the sequels, he gets more insane. Halloween 5 is peak insanity. He literally uses Jamie Strode, who is a 9-year-old child. He uses her as bait. She can't speak because she's so traumatized by Michael Myers. And then she's in the hospital and he's shaking her and yelling at her in her face. And then he uses her as bait to get Michael Myers down the stairs. He's the bad guy. Anyway, Michael Myers, is he an alien? Or is he possessed by an alien? Pure evil, I believe. So if you look at the idea that aliens are demons, I think they're alien. I think aliens could be demons or angels. I think it could go either way. Was Myers possessed by a demonic alien? Or was he a demonic alien? Seems outrageous, right? But hear me out. The film we see John Carpenter's obsession with is The Thing from Another World. I think I called it The Thing from Outer Space earlier. That was wrong. It's the Howard Hawks' version from the 50s. It's called The Thing from Another World. And in Carpenter's remake in 1982, simply called The Thing, it's about projecting fears, and this shape-shifting alien is a parasite who takes over the host's mind and works with what's already in existence. And when it takes over the host, very much like David Icke's theory of archons and shape-shifting aliens. Listen to my show about Queen Elizabeth and the shape-shifting lizard theory I did in September. But also John Carpenter, if you recall, did They Live with Rowdy Roddy Piper and was it David Craig or Craig David? Anyway, it's about reptilian alien people possessing human bodies. So you can see how these things all fit into the wheelhouse, okay? And if you watch Prince of Darkness, I think it's Prince of Darkness, there's a terrifying scene where the woman says, I'm losing myself. I think that was where it was. Because this Antichrist goo is taking over the bodies. It's a terrifying movie. So John Carpenter has this obsession with aliens possessing human bodies. And then you also look at how the way Myers is staring at Bob when he kills him, it's like an alien analyzing a new species almost. Plus he's eating dogs. Like he was the Alf. Wasn't Alf? No, Alf was eating cats. But also in The Thing, there's a big plot line about the dogs. That's how the movie starts out, was the dog getting possessed by the alien first. So the argument could be that Halloween is more or less a prequel to The Thing or some kind of cousin to it. The pure evil of Michael Myers is simply the evil from outer space possessing a human body. And it's interesting because in Halloween, they call Michael Myers the Shape, because the viewer is supposed to project their fears onto it. That's why the film was so great. It was scary because it delves into the psyche of the viewer and the subconscious, or the shadow, which are themes we've talked about many times on the show. If you're not familiar with it, check out my book, The Dark Path, Amazon, Audible, signed copies on gumroad.com/IsaacW. Links are always in the show notes. But in The Dark Path, we talk specifically about the shadow over and over. So in a way, Michael Myers represents the alien phenomenon. And in those two alien books I wrote, I'm always saying thoughts become belief, become reality, because there's a mental element to it. It's about manifesting from the subconscious, from the shadow realm, you can go as crazy as you want with this, the Kabbalistic Mauve zone, where the fallen angels reside, could all be connected. And that's kind of what Michael Myers, the Shape, is doing, is manifesting the fear from the viewer. So that's it. That's the hot take on Halloween 1978. And I actually watched every single Halloween movie. I put a ranking of my personal favorite ones. You might be shocked at what you see. If you go to my Letterboxd, if you don't know what Letterboxd is, it's just another social media app. Why not? But this one's fun because there's no politics. It's just you talking about movies. You review the movies. Hey, you can follow me over there or just check it out. My username is Isaac Weisop on Letterboxd. Link will be in the show notes, as always. If you go to allmylinks.com/IsaacW, you can find it. But I ranked all of them. You'll be surprised at which ones I think were the best. I'm just going to leave it like that, a little teaser, if you will. I will tell you this. Halloween 1978 is the best one of the bunch, by far. Far and away. And that was the whole movie. I wanted to cover that for Halloween because it's a fun little time of year where we can get a little scared. We can watch a little scary movie and just have a great time and casually talk a little bit about the occult symbolism and how the Illuminati are going to take over the world and the demonic aliens are possessing our bodies. That's all. Okay? All right. Thanks for listening to the show. Until next time, stay woke.